Welcome to Main Engine Cutoff. I am Anthony Colangelo, and we've got a good old friend with us today, Jake Robbins of We Martians, and my co-host of Off Nominal is joining us to talk about Mars exploration in the current time and in the future, talk about the arrival of the 2021 Mars fleet, as I've been calling it, UAE's Hope, Tianwen-1 from China, and Perseverance from NASA. We'll also talk a lot about the future of exploration. It's something that's been on my mind recently as I've seen all these missions go off. There's some questions lingering about what the next, you know, couple of transfer windows looks like for Mars exploration, some strategy about what goes into those decisions, maybe a little bit about the communications, issue that comes up from time to time, this issue of aging orbiters that are our key communications assets and what to do about that. This is a fun one because Jake and I are doing a little bit of a crossover here. So I've actually appeared over on We Martians, his podcast. We talked all about the big rockets and how they apply to some of the Mars beat that Jake follows. So if you have not checked out We Martians, it's a good opportunity to do so. I've got a link over in the show notes or wherever you're listening to this, search for We Martians in there and I will be in, if you're listening to this the day it comes out, the most recent episode of We Martians. But he's got a ton of content that you definitely should check out. And also, as I said, he's my co-host on Off Nominal, which is the other podcast that we do together. More laid back, very fun. We recently had Leo Enright on the show. So definitely check offnom.com out if you have not heard that show. But before Jake gets on here, before we give him a call, I want to say thank you to all of you who makes this kind of thing possible. There are 548 of you out there supporting the show every single month. If you want to be the one that gets us to 550, well, then I think you'll need to find a friend and head over to mainenginecutoff.com/support. This episode was produced by 39 executive producers. Thanks to Brandon, Matthew, Simon, Lauren, Melissa, Chris, Pat, Matt, George, Ryan, Donald, Lee, Chris, Warren, Bob, Russell, Moritz, Joel, Jan, Grant, David, Eunice, Rob, Tim Dodd, the Everyday Astronaut, Frank, Julian, and Lars from Agile Space, Tommy, Matt, the Astrogators at SEE, Chris, and seven anonymous executive producers. That list is awful long. I am very thankful for all of your support. If you want to help support the show, head over to mainenginecutoff.com/support. Jump in there at $3 or more, or $3 a month or more, and you get access to MECO Headlines every single week, which is an entire other podcast in your feeds where I run through every story of the week. It's really a great way to stay up on space news and help support the show. So if you like what I do here, if you want more of it, head over there and join the club. And with that long preamble, let's give Jake a call. Jake Robbins, welcome to Managing Cutoff for the fourth or fifth time.
I can't remember either.
Yeah, I think you are now the most MECO guested person of all time.
I like it.
Congratulations.
I'll take that title. Yeah, that's good.
All right, I want to start by asking you a question because I often tell people like about podcasting I do, and I say I do this show, and I do this other one called Off Nominal with this guy, Jake Robbins, which to everyone out there, you should check out Off Nominal. We just had Leo Enright of Irish TV fame on, which was an amazing episode. So definitely check that out. But when I tell people about this and then I say, this other guy does like a Mars podcast, people are always like, what does that mean? Like, what is a Mars podcast? So can you give me an answer for these people in my life that are asking that question?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm interested in planetary exploration and, both by robots and by humans. And I guess I wanted to make the podcast a little bit different and have a bit of a niche. So I actually just picked one planet to really kind of center my focus on. So I get to unpack all the different kinds of missions that go to Mars. There's rovers, there's orbiters, there's landers. And then I sort of broaden that out a little bit. I touch a little bit on the moon and both surface and orbiter on the moon, just because that's kind of where people are going to be flying next. And if deep space exploration with humans is my beat, then that's kind of where I get to spend some time. But mostly it's just Mars. So we talk about science, so results from the missions, talking about the things we learn about the planet, the geology, the geochemistry, all those kinds of things. We talk about the spacecraft. So the cool technology behind, landing these rovers or flying these missions. We talk about the policy a little bit, and we also talk about humans, like I talk about. So it's kind of a good broad range, but keeping focused allows me to go pretty deep on some of these things, which is really fun, and that's kind of why I like it.
You're like secretly or not so secretly a geology nerd who also likes space a lot, because some of your geology episodes are like, wow, I never have thought about rocks in this way in my life. It's like a view into a different world for me personally, as people probably know from like the content I cover here. I don't cover a lot of planetary exploration, like day-to-day news, So I appreciate your insight on all that stuff. So WeMartians.com, if someone has not checked out, or wherever you're listening to this, just search We Martians in there.
Yeah.
All right. I've brought you here because you are now able to catch your breath after what has been a crazy couple of months for you. The Mars fleet has arrived to some extent. There's one arrival left in terms of Tianwen down to the surface. I would love a little bit of like a recap on how the arrivals went, what some of the early operations are like. So do you want to do this in arrival order?
Sure, yeah.
So that is that Mars Hope from the UAE first?
It is Mars Hope, yeah, by a hair, less than 24 hours before Tianwen 1. I mean, overall, honestly, the whole thing has gone really smoothly. We had, you know, two newcomers to Mars, three spacecraft. Mars is notoriously dangerous for newcomers. You know, their first missions don't often go very well. So considering all that, it all went really, really well. All three of these missions arrived and did everything they needed to do pretty safely and, you know, without issue. So that's kind of great to see. Mars Hope, so that's the, it's a small, well, not that small, but a kind of a simple orbiter by the United Arab Emirates. It's their very first space mission into deep space, their very first one to Mars. A really fascinating story of development with this, because the whole space agency is brand new. This is like literally like their first official project, so it's quite an ambitious one to chew off. And they did everything kind of right and on time and launched, and they made it there and just in time for the country's 50th anniversary. So it's a really nice story. There are some really fascinating people that kind of came up with this project and are now kind of superstars. So that's kind of fun to watch. So it is now in an orbit around Mars, kind of their insertion parking orbit. They're doing some maneuvers this month to kind of get down to their science orbit, but they're kind of good to go. So that's kind of great to see.
I saw some photos started to be released as well. I didn't look in enough to your tweets from the last like day or two or whatever it was that had these images. Can you tell me about those at all? It looked like some sort of multicolored.
Yeah,
it was so a little trippy looking, to be honest.
It's their first. Yeah, it was a bit trippy. It's their first science release. So I'm putting science kind of in quotations there, but because very limited. But so they have three instruments on board. There's kind of like a regular visual camera. Then they have one sort of in the infrared spectrum and one in the ultraviolet spectrum. And so they sort of just took pictures of Mars with all three instruments and released that as a PDF. So that's kind of cool to see. That means all the instruments are working. That's the news that I really took from that is everything's functional, which is great. They'll get a lot more into the pipeline once they get to their science orbit and get their software up and running so that the stuff's just flowing to us more regularly. But it's awesome to see.
One thing before we move on that I heard you say somewhere else about the orbit that it will settle into eventually has this pretty cool like orbital resonance to it, and it can image the entire planet. I would love to hear some more about that from you.
Yeah, so the orbital period on the science orbit for Hope is 2¼ sols, if you will, right? And so basically every 2¼ days, it comes back to the close approach, which means that Mars has turned 1/4 turn. So that's that extra quarter, which means that 4 orbits gives you all 4 quadrants of the planet. You get the total view altogether. So that's kind of an awesome way for them to really, you know, programmatically catalog what the planet looks like over time. And then because there's a low point and a high point, the low point, they get, you know, they go faster, they get closer, they get these kind of high res surface shots. And then the high point, they're able to do full globe images. And so they can kind of get the good, you know, good range of different ways to look at the planet. So it enables them to do a lot of really interesting science. It's focused around the atmosphere. That's kind of what the orbiter is optimized to do. So they're going to be tracking weather and atmospheric loss of, you know, oxygen and hydrogen and different things there. So it's going to be fun. I can't wait for the science to start coming out with it.
And one final bit on this mission. You've had some interviews with people that run the space agency, and also you have now gone two heads of the space agency in the last calendar year in terms of interview rank. And you also had some science and engineering team members on before it launched. I'm going to post those links in the show notes as well, but how was the vibe from the team both before and after talking to these people that are actually working on, you know, hey, we're going to start a space agency. Cool, let's send a Mars orbiter out there. What was that like to kind of get like a pre and post arrival, snapshot of their brains?
It was awesome. So this is what I kind of mean when I talk about the good story, the good feel good story that comes out of this mission, because they built everything from the ground up. And so, you know, if you think about any of those stories where people invent something from nothing, and it's always like it's a rush, and it's death-defying, and it's like really, really scary to do those kind of things. Lots of risk. These are the people that did that. And a lot of them, you know, came from different industries because there was no space industry before this, and so they're learning everything as they go. It's a very young team. It's a very diverse team, and they are just... you can just feel the excitement and the love dripping from their voices. Sometimes we get a little jaded with these, you know, watching an old NASA press conference with a bunch of old guard who have just been through this over and over. And there's just like, there's not much left in them, you know?
This and they're like, landing on Mars is really hard. It's like, you personally have done it like six times. So.
Yeah. It's not that exciting for you anymore, I guess. But this is not the case with the UAE. They're just like, they can't believe what they're doing. They've worked so hard and they're just super, super relieved. So I got to talk to, three members of the team from propulsion, from science team, and from some guidance navigation stuff right after they launched. And so they kind of had that post-launch euphoria that was really, really nice to see. And then I spoke with Sarah Alamiri, who is the president of the UAE Space Agency, just last month, 2 days after they had arrived. And so she was still beaming with joy. And it was just, it was awesome. It was so inspiring to talk to them and feel that that enthusiasm.
All right. One group of team members that you will never talk to. Let's move on to China's mission here. What's going on at this point with Tianwen?
Yeah, so Tianwen 1 is also kind of figuring out its orbit. So it went into this very elliptical orbit to start with. So it was very close on one side and went all the way out to like 180,000 kilometers on the other side. And they had to do that because they had to do a plane change. So they arrived in sort of like an equatorial orbit and they had to go polar so they can start doing reconnaissance on their landing sites. And so they went way out there, did a plane change, and then they came way back and they started lowering it. So they're now in what they're calling their reconnaissance orbit, which is where they are taking pictures of their landing site for the rover, which is still just attached to the orbiter at this point, and you know it's along for the ride, still in space. They're going to spend probably 2 months gathering all the data they need for that landing site and figuring out how they want to approach it, and you know all those kinds of things before they deploy the rover in a very, you know, Viking style deployment and land it on the surface and go from there. So that's kind of what we're waiting on. Like you said, we don't get a ton of information from China. The orbital insertion itself was the most bizarro event to try and follow, because the only information we had, like literally the only source of data, was this amateur radio station in Germany who had pointed their antenna and was picking up the signal, and they were just broadcasting like literally the wavy lines onto YouTube, and we were just watching that trying to decipher what was going on. So it's not quite as fun as doing a NASA one where they're actually forthcoming with data.
I love that whole like the amateur tracker situation though. It makes it a lot of fun.
It was fun, yeah. Know.
It's as much fun as we can have because they're not super open about it. I'm wondering about the way that they arrived at Mars. And I feel like I should know this, but were the Viking orbiters in polar orbits or were they equatorial?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot now. And I think they were, they weren't like, you know, pure equatorial, because they had to photograph quite a few different places. And the landing sites themselves were, especially one of them was pretty high up. So they had to be, you know, if not polar, then they were some sort of like ISS style, like 50, 60 degrees kind of thing. So
I was trying to look it up because it seemed strange to me that they would arrive in such an elliptical equatorial orbit and do that heavy plane change instead of trying to arrive in a way that sets them up for polar early on. I don't know.
I mean, I
haven't done the math, but it just seems like you could do the plane change, you know, on one of your trajectory correction maneuvers, and it would be. I've played a lot of KSP.
You know. Me too. Yeah. I think it has to do with coming in equatorially means you can use Mars's gravity to bend that insertion burn a little easier. So I think you save fuel on the insertion burn, even though you spend some momentum
into Mars itself. Yeah,
okay. Exactly.
That makes sense. All right, I've settled that now in my brain. the imager on Tianwen is supposed to be like MRO-ish. Is it is there any sense as to like the image is going to come out on that at all? Is that something that we'll see at some point? Do you think it's going to be as good as a high-rise cam has been putting out there?
Yeah, well, not quite as good as high-rise. So like Tianwen has basically two cameras the same way that the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter does. There's like a high-res one and a medium resolution one. They're both just like slightly worse than the MRO ones. So I think high-rise can do 30, 40 centimeter resolution, which is crazy. Like that's super high-res. The Tianwen one is maybe 2 meters. So not quite as good, but still pretty high res versus the context camera on high res, which is like 6 meters. And then their medium resolution one is actually, it's way more. It's like 100 meters or something. So, but the same sort of strategy where they're going to have a wide field of view to take large pictures. And then they use the high resolution one to pinpoint landing spots and things like that. So the important thing there to note, I believe, is that the Tianwen-1 high resolution camera is better than MRO's medium resolution one, which means that they are going to be learning new things. They're going to be photographing parts of Mars which have never been seen at that resolution before. So I think it's pretty important. I think that's why they're doing the scouting orbit, because high rise is great, but it has not done full coverage of Mars. They don't have like 100% of the planet photographed. So because it's such a high resolution, you can't take that many photographs. So they're using that to get their own data about their landing sites and really, understand it. So I think it's gonna be good. I think it's gonna be pretty useful data. Now, as for when they're gonna release it and if they're gonna release it and how, I really have no answer for you.
Unless the guy in Germany who's been doing all the radio signal stuff. He'll be decoding them before they actually put anything out.
Yeah, I'm sure they're well encrypted too, but we can look to sort of the moon missions for some sort of guidance on that, I think. So Chang'e 3, 4, 5 are science missions to the moon. And China has released data for those, not in any way the way that NASA does it, where it's like a pipeline that just gets streamed to the internet. They were waiting like in year chunks and just doing a release you download as like a big zip file or something. So they give their scientists a chance to really do their work with it first before they share it with the world.
I didn't realize that MRO had not covered all parts of Mars. That's an interesting tidbit. Like, this is going to actually be breaking some new ground. I did not realize that. So that's cool to hear.
With the high resolution camera.
Right.
So
yeah,
the context one is covered like 99% of it. So, high rise is just, it's too focused. So, even though it's been around, today's actually its 15th birthday in orbit as we talked today. So, even though it's been around for 15 years, it hasn't been able to really cover the whole planet. They do a lot of like seasonal, observations with high rise where they take the picture of the same place over and over and over again, and so that kind of burns up some of their cycles, right?
Yeah, and now they're tracking too many rovers and all that, and they got to be covering landing sites and whatnot. So the one thing I fear with Tianwen is that everything has gone so well at Mars this arrival season. So that makes me nervous. It's like, this is going too well. Do you think, I don't even want to put you on the spot, do you think they have a good shot at like sticking this? Or
it's going to be hard, man. I mean, this of the four spacecraft that have to kind of, get to their destinations this season, this is the one I'm most worried about. NASA's a pro at this. They know how to land stuff on the surface. And the EDL sequence for Tianwen is something that China has never done before. They've landed on the moon, but there is no atmosphere there. And it is a whole different ballgame. All this, time delay, everything, it's a lot for them. So I'm keeping an eye on it, but if there's a place where it's going to go wrong, to me it feels like this is the place. I'm knocking on wood here to make sure I don't curse it, but I'm a little nervous too.
That'll be interesting to see how that goes, and then how the news is rolled out. Because if it goes poorly, it might be like September before they say anything.
Yeah,
we actually might find out from High Rise before anyone else. Be like, it's this new crater. All right, let's talk about Perseverance now. I can't even say it, let alone type it. Everything went incredibly. If anyone's listening to this and has not, seen the videos and the images that have been released of the entry, descent, landing, I don't actually know how you ended up here, quite honestly. And I think you should pause and go look at all that kind of stuff. So we don't have to cover all of the rollout. Everything went great. The images and videos are incredible. Unless you have anything specific to say about that stuff, I'd love to hear, now that we are into their early operations, all these instruments are being deployed, they've started to drive, where things are at with this, what you're expecting to see over the next couple of weeks, and anything notable that you've seen yet from the mission.
Yeah, so they're doing all the really exciting stuff right now of powering up this rover. So getting it to the surface is one thing, and then you kick over to operations, and they have all these software upgrades to do. They got to release all the mechanisms so the mass can stand up and the antenna can flex and the arm can move around. And then they did their first drive. They're powering up instruments one by one and calibrating them. So it's really been an exciting couple of weeks, sort of like, because you get like a milestone every day or two where something new has happened. So it's been fun to watch. One thing that's really hit me by surprise, and it shouldn't have, but it has, because I've just been so focused on sort of the EDL and the big picture with the mission. But like the the cameras on this thing are just incredible. Like, they're just way better than I expect. I think in my brain, I just sort of said it's close enough to Curiosity. They don't need to think about it. And I just expect the same thing, but like every camera is better. The nav cams are in full color this time and they have this really rich, chocolatey color to them. So they're just lovely to see. The Mass Cam Z on the top of the mast did this full 360 degree panorama, and the zoom capability on this thing are just like unbelievable. I cannot believe this picture. I mean, we talked about it on Off Nominal. It was like my pick for what this can do. I've pulled this up on my 38 inch monitor and just stared at it for like 10, 20 minutes before. You can scroll side by side, look at the rocks in the foreground, look at the rocks in the background, and it's all like super high res. It's just awesome to see. So I'm so excited for what these cameras are going to be able to do. You know, Mastcam's got video capability. We're going to take some pictures of a helicopter pretty soon, which is like insane to even think about. And I don't know what we're going to do with that. It's going to be incredible. We've gotten some audio recordings now, so we have microphones in this thing, which is great for podcasters. I'm going to be using these sounds in all kinds of different ways, I hope. And yeah, so they're moving now. So the rover is driven something like 70, 80 meters away from its landing site. They're trying to find a helipad right now for the helicopter so they can do their test flights. And that's going to be a whole other big event that we have to kind of watch for. It's going to be fun.
It's interesting the way the helicopter has been positioned. You know, it is a tech demo. They're setting the expectations accordingly. But it's such an early priority. Like, they need to do this as the first thing. And that was even in the press conferences, where it's like, we're prioritizing getting the helicopter down, getting it deployed, doing the flight. Do you get the sense that, I guess, what led to that being the order of operations? Like, that we'll do the helicopter and then we'll do all the science mission stuff. And do you get any sense that people are getting antsy? Or was this built-in waiting period something that they planned for to take advantage of early on to do, you know, to look at the landing site, figure out the plans? Like, they essentially have a little bit more time to plan their future science work. I'm just curious about that balance between tech demo and then getting on with the science.
Yeah, well, there is one technical reason that's driving that decision. So the helicopter right now is fastened to the bottom of the rover, and it's kind of like hanging down underneath it, and it has this big protective cover on it, and it lowers the profile of the bottom of the rover enough that they can't use their auto navigation software with it. So basically, the Perseverance is equipped to move a lot faster than Curiosity. It's got a lot more ground to cover, a lot more samples to collect, and all those kind of things. So it's going to try and drive on the order of twice as far in the same amount of time. And to do that, they have this advanced, you know, AI-driven auto navigation software where the rover can sort of watch for rocks and move around them and not get slowed down by them. But I guess they need that clearance. I think part of the logic includes driving over rocks if they're small enough. And right now they'd be hitting the helicopter as they drove over. So they can't do that until they get rid of this thing. So that's kind of the big technical reason. But I think there's also just some benefits in terms of, you know, you're going to be landing in a roughly safe area because that's just by nature how it has to work. And so I may as well fly in a safe area as well. That's one way to kind of think about it.
And I suppose the other half is that, like, hey, if this thing works, it would benefit our science mission a lot, because then we can do a better job scouting tomorrow's drive, or we can do a better job looking at what's just over the horizon or just beyond the corner. So it does probably, you know, lean them in certain directions if they do have a helicopter that is operational to make better decisions as they drive up this river delta. That'll be cool to see how that integrates, you know, with the mission at large.
That's one where they're being really coy with it, right? So they're really laying on the tech demo part of it. Like, this is probably going to break and we shouldn't expect to ever need it ever. Like, do not count on this in any way. But knowing NASA, it'll probably work pretty good.
Well, I was going to say, if you listen to my appearance on We Martians that is happening as well, they probably should have contacted someone from the SLS Green Run team and just had a quick chat about expectation setting. It's good examples of, you know, the two ways to go about this.
I hope it flies and that it's actually useful and they're able to, you know, I don't think it'll last a winter. Like, even if it works really great, I think it'll probably, I mean, to me, it should just crash. That should be like the way it goes. That's like an honorable death for it. But even if it doesn't, like, just the winter will be tough on that little guy. But I hope that in the meantime, it will have an opportunity to contribute a little bit to the science and guide this rover around and get some scouting done, because that'd be pretty cool proof of concept for how this would work in a more, you know, traditional manner.
Maybe someday they can, instead of using a sky crane, you just land the sucker with a helicopter.
You know? There you go, yeah.
That solves two problems at once.
It's a dragonfly approach, yeah.
There you go. All right, let's talk about some future stuff now, because for a long time, and I'm going to talk specifically about NASA here, I feel like we've been in this mode where there's always another rover coming down the line. We've got all these big flagship missions that we can kind of count on. You know, we were driving around with Spirit and Opportunity talking about Curiosity. We were landing Curiosity, talking about Mars 2020. We are now at the point where Mars 2020 is the first of the three sample return missions. This is going to be caching samples across the surface. And I think in its, is it going to keep a couple of samples as well? Like on board or something?
It's going to try and not to. I think it's going to try and get rid of all of them, right?
Dump them all out. So Mars sample return program itself is going to be this series of missions, but that's really the last big managed mission that NASA has. I would love to hear a little bit about what, as somebody like yourself who's looking at, like, we need more Mars missions, what is coming up on the exploration roadmap, non-NASA and NASA alike, and, you know, how do you see that going over the next decade or so?
Yeah, well, you hit the nail on the head in terms of, like, it's an inflection point, right? Because just like you said, so the Mars sample return mission, which is three missions, but, you know, one big program, is basically just dominating the entire Mars exploration program right now at NASA. It's the only thing they're thinking about. It's a huge budget sink. You know, it's got a tremendous amount of technical risk and a tremendous amount of reward on the line. So it's a big, big project, and so much that it's actually got its own, like, organizationally, like, they keep it outside of the Mars exploration office. There's like a whole MSR sort of group that lives outside of that, and they kind of come in from the side and report directly into HQ. Like, they're very, very focused on this, getting it right. But there's also all these other circumstances happening at the same time. The infrastructure at Mars is aging. You know, we just talked about Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, 15 years old today. It's like one of the younger orbiters. Odyssey's 20 years old. So there's a lot of stuff going on in terms of the infrastructure and having to make decisions about that if you want to keep doing things the way you've always done them. There's a new decadal survey happening right now. So NASA sort of commissions these reports every 10 years to ask for the community consensus on, you know, where to go next with science. And the one we're in right now is expiring in a year and a half or so. And so they're building the next one. That's going to be driving some change into the program for sure. And then we have all these commercial developments in space. You know, we're seeing a lot of change happening at the moon in terms of science because of commercial opportunities and the launch industry. How is that going to affect Mars? We don't really know yet. And so it really does feel like there is a bit of an inflection point in terms of, like, the program for NASA. So NASA thankfully did sort of see this coming. And about right before the pandemic, they commissioned a report that was basically asking, you know, can you solve the problem of how do we explore Mars while we're doing Mars sample return? You know, how do we not give up on everything else while we try to do this? What's the solution there? And that report actually came out just this past November. It didn't get a lot of headlines, but it's starting to kind of surface a little bit now. And there are some ways to do it. There's some really interesting solutions that they're presenting in terms of, like, leveraging small satellites and trying to break down science into more manageable chunks. And, you know, they're calling them, like, these mission arcs and stuff. And they're trying to build a series of missions where you can start with something cheap, like a small sat, and then maybe move to a Discovery or New Frontiers class and really kind of get that going. So you can still do stuff. But a lot of technology development as well. That's one of their big focuses, is saying, let's invest in some of these small satellite technologies and other kind of instrument technologies so that when Mars sample return is done, you're set and ready to go to answer the next big question. So there's a lot of stuff up in the air right now. It's quite a big thing.
One thing that was interesting from that report was I liked the way that they phrased it. Was like, decide the data that you want and then essentially start with the smallest spacecraft you can to get that data.
Yeah.
I liked that as a model, because I don't know how this stuff has went internally, but it kind of felt like, hey, let's do a big flagship rover. What can we do with it? You know, now we have a one ton rover on the surface, and it flips that, right? And it's like, okay, well, we just want this one thing. Can we send a 200 kilogram satellite to do that? If that were the future model, I would be into that.
Yeah. And the Mars exploration program has followed to sort of the one big science objective, right? They started with kind of follow the water, and now they're looking for signs of habitability and signs of life. Like, it's always been this kind of top line question, which the flagships have been really going after. So breaking them into these mission arcs is interesting, like you said. So, you know, one of the arcs, for example, is like looking at ancient environments and habitability. So it's like a very specific part of Mars science. And they the report kind of came up with four examples of different arcs you could do. I don't know if NASA will actually go through with those ones or different ones or whatever, but it's an interesting concept. And it does actually line up with what the decadal survey is planning. So we do know that this decadal survey coming out is going to have a bit of a different format. In the past, they've always sort of presented like chapters of the report as like locations. So like, here's the Venus chapter, here's the Mars chapter, here's the ocean worlds chapter, and here's the missions and science you should do in those places. They're kind of flipping that and looking at questions instead. So like, if we want to go look for life, here's the missions you should go. And some of those will be to Mars and some of those will be to Europa, et cetera. And so by putting the science objective before the location, it flips that around. That kind of is in line with this. And so maybe the way to win at Mars now is because we have so many orbiters and landers and rovers there, and we have such a broad data set with Mars, maybe we should be looking more granular now and breaking those down and sort of letting different parts of the community go after those things and seeing which ones go farther and faster, right?
The decadal survey itself, being focused on that kind of level of like, here are the answers that we want. I'm interested in like, you know, we have these converging storylines of new decadal survey and new technology developments like Marco A and B, where these CubeSats that helped out with InSight's arrival that worked out really well, so it sort of proved out the viability of small satellites in interplanetary space. Where do those things come together? Is that a NASA program decision to say, we got to answer these questions and now we have this technology to do it? Or does the decadal survey itself take that context into consideration?
It does a little bit. So the survey is primarily focused on the science questions that need to be answered, but it takes in the context of, you know, what missions are already flying, so which data sets would be complementary. It looks into workforce, it looks into technology and cost, it looks into rockets. So there's a lot of things that kind of factor in it, because really, like, the science community, what they want is they want to set up NASA for success, right? They want to be able to say, like, this is our recommendation for the way forward that we think has the highest probability of success. And so NASA takes that as a recommendation, as a pretty serious recommendation. It weighs a lot into their decisions, but then ultimately they do have to make those decisions, because then all the politics and then the budget lines come into play, and they have to sort of balance those things. But the survey is pretty comprehensive. Like, when these things come out, they're 300-400 page reports. And, you know, there's a lot to read into them if you want to really get into the nitty gritty of what the science community wants to do.
And that's right there is why you listen to We Martians, because I'm not reading that thing. I'll tell you that right now.
I don't even read the full report, so don't worry about it.
All right. One other bit that's kind of related to that question is this concept of communications at Mars is a thing. You mentioned the old orbiters. We're very reliant on this. I mean, you can talk to all the rovers direct from Earth and direct back to Earth, but it's very low bandwidth. It's not preferred. That's kind of a worst case scenario. So the communications problem has been something that we've talked about for years. There was recently this idea floated, or I don't even know exactly what form that was in. I can't remember at this point, to have a commercial company bid on these communication services, send a satellite to orbit, potentially even a small constellation of satellites in orbit to provide communication services. This seems like something that is massively important. In the same way of that last question, would the decadal survey have the purview to say, like, Mars is really important for these questions, but we can't do anything without having communications? Or would that be a decision that the higher-ups at NASA headquarters would need to say, like, we have to prioritize this? I guess I'm looking for, like, who can I be annoyed at that we don't have this program yet?
Yeah, it's a tricky decision, because it's not direct science, right? So, like, the decadal survey they're tracking that because they're realizing, you know, if they have problems getting data back, especially if there's data that gets captured on board a spacecraft and never makes it home because there's no room in the pipe. Right.
And that's why Mars is different, is that, like, we have all of these things there now. Like, yeah, communications orbiter around the moon or Venus would be cool as well, but nothing is dependent on that. And that's why I'm leaning this direction, is that, like, this seems like a thing that should be causing major strife in the people that are writing the decadal survey.
Yeah, and especially we just, you know, we talked about Perseverance and all this high resolution stuff and video. Like, they're going to soak up a lot of, like, this rover has already been real chatty with, like, every orbiter. You know, Odyssey, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, they're leveraging bonus bandwidth from the European Trace Gas Orbiter, and MAVEN is now, like, had to adjust its orbit to accommodate more relays. So they're making a lot of compromises in order to make this work. So you'd think it would be an important thing to do. I'm sure the survey will identify it as a risk, you know, to say this is something that's affecting us now. Ultimately, though, that is sort of an implementation detail, so probably falls more on the NASA side rather than the science community. But I think it all ends up tracing back to, like we talked about, this inflection point. NASA needs to make a conscious decision right now. Do we want to continue the Mars program the way we have for the last 20 years? Because that was also a conscious choice where they said, let's not send one mission to Mars. Let's send one every window and see what all this science in aggregate can do together. You know, is the sum of all the missions at Mars greater than their individual parts? I think we've learned that yes, it is, but it also comes with a cost. And so with this sample return sort of coming into a choke point in the program, NASA needs to make that decision. Do we want to, after sample return, go back to the same format and keep sending a mission every launch window, in which case maybe an infrastructure investment like a communications orbiter makes sense? Or are they saying, actually, you know what, this is sort of reached the end. We need to get people here, or we need to, you know, to solve these questions from the decadal, we need to spend more time at Europa and mm-hmm. Venus or whatever. We'll have to kind of see. So it's another point where we need to kind of wait for a decision, which is really interesting, right?
Yeah, for you personally, it might be a bit of a bummer, but it is a very interesting moment in time where, like, you know, you're right in that we sort of had settled into, like, this model, and it dominated the conversations about planetary exploration throughout the solar system. So, you know, that it does definitely seem like we're going to get some large answers, and maybe the commercial communications thing is a leading indicator. If they do extend that as an official program, that would indicate that they need that for the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So maybe that's a good first thing to watch for.
And there's also this whole commercial side of it, right? So we've seen in other different areas in space where once the cost of it becomes too much for a government, you try and find out how much you can offload into the private sector, right? One of the things that this report we just talked about identified was that there should definitely be, I don't know if it's the right answer, but we should definitely be exploring the idea of a CLPS program for Mars. So a commercial Mars payload services, whatever you want to call it. It's not a good of an acronym, but so, you know, is there a market for payloads to the surface of Mars? I don't know. Probably not. That doesn't really scream to me like
I think we're still trying
there.
To answer that question on the moon, honestly.
Yeah, right, I was going to say, I'm still out to lunch on the moon part of that one. So we'll see. But maybe communications is the place where we can offload some of that cost, right? And see if it, I can't imagine that's not something SpaceX would want to jump at, right? Because they're going to want to set up their own Mars infrastructure and getting practice operating a spacecraft in Mars orbit, communicating a bunch of data back. They can do all kinds of stuff there, leveraging their Starlink technology. It's a perfect fit. They just got to get all the ducks lined up, right?
Every day that goes by, I'm shocked that they have not done that yet. Like, yeah. It just seems like a thing that they should have done. So I am with you on that being a thing that we should watch for in the future and that they should do. So I think that's the end of my list here, Jake. I would, if there's anything I missed that we should talk about at Mars, or if not, everyone should go listen to We Martians.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty good rundown. There's a lot going on still. So the arrivals are all done, but there's plenty of events happening. Like, say, Perseverance is going to be real exciting over the next, you know, 4 to 8 weeks as this helicopter gets off the ground. They're going to have their first sample drilled, you know, in the spring, which is going to be fantastic. This whole complicated sample caching system that's, you know, the most complex instrument we've ever sent to another planet. So it's going to be fun to watch.
Let me do a little plug for you as well. If you're somebody who listens to this show and you listen to MECO Headlines that I do every week, Jake does a similar thing about Mars. And a part of that every week is like the surface updates. And you track all the things that Perseverance is doing on the surface. And I feel like it's something that if people are curious about every turn that it makes and what it's doing, what it's deploying, that is like a must-have thing in your podcast feed. So you can clip that out and use it on your show.
I appreciate that. I stole the idea from you, fully admit it. So it's a good little format, but you know, I cover the ops every week. So even Curiosity, which is not getting a lot of headlines right now, I'm still talking about how far it drove and where it drilled and what it's looking at. So it's fun to kind of keep a tabs on these missions as they proceed through their lifespans.
All right. Well, thanks, Jake. Hopefully you'll be back again to contain or to keep your title here on the most most often Miko guest.
Yeah. Every time that Peter Beck comes on, I got to make sure I get on right after that just to keep the
There you go. Keep him at bay. Thanks again to Jake for coming on the show. It's always great to do these crossover episodes with him. As I mentioned up front, I'm appearing over on the We Martians feed as well alongside this episode. So check that out if we want to talk about the big rockets that we tend to track here on the show. We talk a little bit about how it applies to some of the things that Jake's looking at. And it's a great time to check out We Martians if you have not yet and get that in your life, because it's definitely an awesome show. And as we talked about, Red Planet Review is definitely a go-to of mine. Keeps me up to date, and it should keep you up to date as well. But for now, that's all I've got for you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the support, as always, at managingcutoff.com/support. If you've got any questions or thoughts, hit me up on email, anthony@managingcutoff.com, or on Twitter @WeHaveMiko. And until next time, hope you're enjoying all the space news and all the podcasts, and I'll talk to you soon.